Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and happy new year. This is 2013, and I am so excited about what this year is going to bring. I am so excited about the possibilities. It's a new year, a new day, a new me. It's got to be a new you. Tonight, I'm so excited. This is a Black History Month, and we celebrate leaders that have made impact in our community. Horace Mann said that we should be ashamed to die until we've made a major contribution to mankind. And one of the men I want to pay tribute to tonight is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., better known as the Dreamer. He had a dream one day that we would all be able to walk unified as one. He had a dream that at the time didn't seem possible, but he persevered and he gave his life, he gave his time so that we might be free. I have with me my co-host Shirley Carter. Shirley, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, everyone, and Happy New Year's. This is 2013. This is it. This is our year.
This is indeed it.
Yes.
I see we have a lot of people listening live online and have called in and listening by telephone, and I see people have their hands up, so they want to be able to make comment tonight. But as we were talking today, Shirley, I said, you know, I loved the presentation of Dr. King's speech and all of the things that he had said. You know, a lot of times we just focus on the part where he says, "I have a dream," and talks about how he wishes that, you know, black girls and white girls would play together and that we'll all be equal and considered one. But there was a whole lot more that he said prior to that. If you would, Shirley, do you have the speech in front of you?
Yes, I do.
If you were to read an excerpt, the whole thing is a great speech. It's long, but if you want, you can read an excerpt that would mean that stimulated you, that got you excited. I remember when he made this speech back in 1963, I was 3 years old. But I remember the speech because my whole family was sat around that black and white television. It was like it was a spectacular event. And I remember seeing this man speak with such eloquence and such power and such magnitude, yeah, and all the people that were surrounding him. And I was like, wow. You know, at that age, you didn't know anything about black or white. But at that age, I knew this was a man of power. I remember when Dr. King was assassinated. Again, it was as though my world stood still. I was watching the television. I watched the emotions of my grandmother, and then my mother came in from work, and my grandmother was crying, and my mom came in. And I remember the hollering, "Oh, they shot Dr. King. They shot Dr. King." And I was like, who is this Dr. King? And my family began to tell me who he was and that, you know, they had killed him. And I moaned, I grieved within my spirit about this because it was like 8 years later because he got killed in 68 and the speech was done in 63. So I was like 8 years old at the time. So I remembered what a traumatic shift it was in my life. And at that moment, it seemed, I think at that moment, that's when I grabbed a hold of the fact that I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to be somebody of stature. I wanted to be somebody that made a difference because I saw this man that wanted to change our world, and he gave his life for it. And at that moment, I think that's when it was in my spirit that I wanted to do more. So if you would, read an excerpt of part of Dr. King's speech that moved you.
What moved me, I like to say this before I read it, is that because I'm from Mississippi, and when he talked about Mississippi, that moved me. And even though I was a young girl at the time, but that had an impact on my life, and that's a part of the speech that really impacted me. He said, I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, with the that would transform an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their characters. I have a dream. And that impacted me and still impacts my life today, because we have been judged by the color of our skin for years and years and years to come. And being a mother, my dream, too, is that my children would not be judged by the color of their skin, even though that is still very prevalent, not just in Mississippi, but in the whole United States. We're still dealing with it. So,
you know, Shirley, the tragedy.
Yes.
The tragedy of it all and why I was prompted to do this is because, you know, we take so much for granted. So many of our ancestors have laid the foundation, they've sacrificed, and they've given their lives for us to be able to hold better jobs, for us to thrive in corporate America, for us to be entertainers, for us to be athletes. And we take it for granted, and we look down on those that are still struggling because we supposedly have arrived. And that's not what Dr. King's dream was about. And the other tragedy above all is that teenagers have no idea who Dr. Martin Luther King is or who he was, what was his significant impartation to the earth. They haven't a clue, because a lot of them are kids that don't know who Dr. King were. They were born by children who, you know, dropped out of school, didn't get their education, and, you know, they just funneled that down, babies having babies with no educational influence in their life at all, except for what they see on the color televisions now. They don't even appreciate the fact that it is color and not black and white anymore. The sacrifices that our ancestors did, you know, one of the things I've talked about often on Hot Topics from the Soul is one of the greatest women that influenced my life was Althea Gibson. I remember reading her book when I was about, I'd say 10 years old, and her book was called I Always Wanted to Be Somebody. And that title alone grabbed me because, like I said, 8 years old, I knew I wanted more. Whatever that more was, I knew I wanted it. And I saw that title, and this woman was on there. And I picked up the book in the library, and I began stroking through the pages and stuff, and she was talking about how she was, you know, in the ghetto-like area, her surroundings, the pictorial that she laid out in the book reminded me of my surroundings. And she began to talk about how she thrived and wanted to play tennis and all this and all the things that she did in order to complete her goal. And that book helped me go through so many difficult times in my life because I remembered this young woman's struggle. And I said, if she can do it, I can do it. And that is not what's passed down, what's portrayed here in our local communities. We've taken so much for granted. Our heroes are the drug dealers. Our heroes are the athletes. Our heroes are no longer our mom and dad who work by the sweat of their brows. Our heroes are no longer our grandparents that struggle and scrub the floors so that we can be able to eat in restaurants and go to the bathroom when we're, that so much has been taken for granted. And I wanted to do a show like this, and hopefully some of the listeners will replay it for their teenagers, for their young adults, so that they can be put in remembrance of the sacrifices that were made for us to be who we are.
Amen. Amen.
I have
and you know what? The other thing, too, Val, is that we have got to reach back to our young people and educate them about who the true heroes are and how do we get them refocused on looking at their role model as their parent. What do we need to do? It's like something is missing. But what is it missing? Something is missing.
Wow. I don't know what the answer is, but one thing I do know is we have to start, and we have to start somewhere, and that somewhere begins in the home. That somewhere begins with communication. That somewhere begins with love and understanding and listening to what's on the heart of our people and extracting that which is in their mind to rightly divide what is true versus a fantasy. And we're so busy hustling and bustling and trying to get the American dream instead of trying to live what the true dream was that Dr. King expressed and talked about. I have a lot of lines lit up here, but I will begin with the caller on 8868. The last four digits, do you have a comment?
Yes,
you're live.
I just wanted to say, hello?
Yes, you're
hello?
Live.
Hello?
You're live.
Oh, okay, thank you for accepting my call. This is Sherry Rudolph, and you're absolutely right. I remember the day that Dr. King died, and I was in the seventh grade, and remember the havoc and the chaos and all the turmoil and the grief that occurred when Dr. King was gunned down by a coward. I would like to also say that it is all of our responsibility to teach our children and to teach young people who come behind us about his legacy. And so many times you can't leave it up to others like the parents or the teachers. And if you are in a mentor role, then that's something you need to share with the young people that are involved in your life. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that information, Cheryl. This is the station we do. We all remember, okay, that moment. It was just such a pivotal time in our history that it just was a great hush. I can't explain it any other way except for the hush, the solidarity in it all. Caller 2175, you are live. Caller, you're live, 2175.
Hi, this is Marie. Hi, thank you so much for letting me share. I'm from Albany, Georgia. I'm living here in Fort Lauderdale now. But they had a lot of the mass meetings in my home. And as they were having the mass meetings, a lot of people got killed at that time. A lot of people got beaten. A lot of people got put in jail. A lot of girls got raped and stuff like that. A lot of things happened with these mass meetings. And when they had these mass meetings, and this was, you know, during the time that he was trying to segregate, you know, to try and, you know, get us to be with the black, you know, be with, you know, all nationalities, because that's what it really is, you know. He was trying to get all nationalities to be able to cope together and to live together to the way we are today. And in my home right now, the church is still there, and they have it as a historic place now. And it's, you know, just to think about, you know, the things that happened, you know, during the time that he was trying to get this, what happened in today, even with the president. You know, he said that these things shall happen, and these things are happening, you know, and they have been happening ever since the day he died. You know, he got killed when they assassinated him. But, it, you know, just to think about, you know, the people that, you know, didn't make it, And just to think about the people that are living now, you know, I'm one of them as to where that, you know, the things that happened to us, you know, during that time, you know, like you would get put in jail for nothing, you know, you would get beat for nothing, you know. You couldn't, you know, I was one of them that you couldn't go to the water fountain because it said the white, and then you couldn't go, you know, like to the bathroom. And, I mean, it was just bad, you know, and hopefully, you know, people will start teaching the young kids and letting them know exactly what's really going on, because it's just shutting down, and it shouldn't shut down, because we should know where we come from. And it's a lot of things that was made in this world was made by black people, and a lot of people don't know that. Not only children, a lot of grown people don't either. So we should, you know, give a lot of these things in consideration. And thanks so much for letting me share, and Happy New Year's to everybody, and God bless you all.
Thank you so much. One of the excerpts in Dr. King's speech, he says, "I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulation. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where quests for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends, though even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Okay, callers that are on the line, and Shirley, you can start out. From that excerpt, do you think that much has changed? We've transitioned a lot here in society, but do you think that some of the things that Dr. King spoke about that were there in 1963 still hold some bearing today?
Yes, I still think so. I think we've polished up some, but there's still so much work still yet to be done. And I think, as a whole, we have gotten complacent, and that we have somehow gotten so evolved and distracted from the work that he started that we have become comfortable in our status quo. And when I say our status quo, that we have become comfortable with our lives as they are. We have accepted so many things that it will not change. That's why you hear a lot of people say, well, you know, it's always been like that. But why does it have to stay like that? It stays like that because we have become complacent and comfortable, or tolerate our living condition and our environment, that we just exist. Some of us are just existing. Some are comfortable in where they're at. Some are saying, look, I got to get mine. I'm not going to worry about the other one. But the point is, we were all supposed to be working on a dream, the dream that he had for everyone. And that was a dream that for one day we will all be able to come together, live together, work together, and grow together. But there's still that divided line. There's no longer that sign that says this is for whites and this is for blacks, or colored or white, or whatever you want to call it. But the line is, the signs are not there, but there's still that little subtleness about it, that entitlement that some people have, that they're entitled to certain things because this is what they were born into. So they're entitled to it, and you have to earn that entitlement. Or they feel like if you're given that entitlement, then you are being given something that you don't deserve. So I say that there's still a lot of work to do. It still holds true today to a lot of the things. He asked us to go back to these areas and make a difference and start anew and build from that. but somewhere, like I said, we're becoming complacent, and a lot of work is still yet to be done.
Okay, you know, I'm going to get a little controversial here because
okay.
we are having a conversation. I'm going to get a little controversial here. Now, one of the things, you know, we as people of color, we have what many will say is that Adamic nature, that nature of violence, that nature of rage. And it sometimes has nothing to do with where they were raised, where they were brought up. They just have it in them where they're just angry and they've not been through anything that Dr. King or any of our parents went through. But they have this rage of it's me, myself, and I'm mad at the world because of what? Somebody help
me
understand.
Well, I want to comment on that, and I think that it's not so much that they've actually gone through anything like what we've gone through back in Dr. King days and everything, but when I speak about that sullenness and that complacentness, they still deal with issues today that we dealt with on a different level back then. Now, instead of being calm about it, you find that more and more young people and that they're more action, and their action is not so much being communicating. They're more of a physical reaction. They react. So that's where I see a lot of anger comes in at, and frustration. And because I've said it many times that we may not be in slavery as slavery was back in the 60s and the 50s or, you know, the 40s, that there's no longer the whip, but there's that pen. That ballpoint pen can put you away for the rest of your life. If a judge signs an order to put you in prison, you're gone. You are no longer in a plantation or you're behind bars now. There's a whole different era. There's a whole different type of mentality, a whole different type of slavery, but you're still bound, because when you look at our justice system, and I'm speaking about young people, you find more young black males in prison than you do in schools, at colleges. There are more behind bars. There are more getting longer sentences than their adversaries, than their, you know, say a white male or even a Hispanic male. You will find that more young black men are being incarcerated for the same crime that someone else would do, that their white partner would do or counterpart would do, but they get the maximum sentence or even beyond maximum. And why? Because I look at it, so it brings about an anger. I hear so many young people talk about how I can't stand authority. I can't stand the cops. I can't stand this person. So even when they're in school, it's almost like they walk in with a defense that they have to have the guards up. So
that's what I'm talking about. Thank you for getting there. That's the point I was trying to make in the beginning, that they walk with this anger, this rage, and this self is entitled where they don't want to be subject to authority. I mean, you got 8 and 7, 8 and 9 year olds killing people and not having any remorse whatsoever. They're like, oh, well, I killed them. I mean, just a few weeks ago, this young boy, 12 years old, killed both his parents. And then after he killed them, he called the police and said, I think my mom and dad is dead. And they were like, well, you think they're dead? What happened to him? He was like, I killed them. They had him playing. They had a recording of the conversation of his 911 call, and he was calm. And they were like, are you in your house alone? And then he had a moment and thought about it, and he says, yes, I'm alone. Oh, I shot them. They're dead. Somebody come. I'm scared. And then the 911 operator was like, well, calm down. Okay, we're sending some help. And he was like, okay, and she was talking to him and trying to find out, okay, how did you get to this point where you got this gun and killed your parents? And he wasn't a black person. He was somebody white. But I'm just saying that our young people and people, you know, we got to be careful and watching. They're learning this behavior not because they've been experienced discrimination, not because somebody has mistreated them, but because they have this built-in thing that, okay, I'm going to do this my way, and if you don't like it, it's just too bad.
Well, I think one of the things, you know, it was really interesting. I'm so glad you went to this point, because I had a conversation with one of my sons today, and we were talking about children, because he has a daughter now, so he's getting this different mindset going as to being a parent and what he needs to do as far as being the right, you know, doing the right thing for her. And even as far as what she watches on television. And I asked him, I said, why do you let her watch certain things and not other things? He said, because there's a subliminal message, he says, in some of the stuff that the kids watch. He said, I don't really think a lot of parents are not paying attention. He said, I watch these shows with her to see what is going on. He said, and I'm going to give you one of the shows he talked about, because his daughter watches Dora. I said, well, what is it about Dora? And then there was this character on there called Swiper. And he said, now, what do you know about Swiper? I said, well, I just saw him. He said, Mom, he's a thief. He's always stealing. And he said, didn't you look at Dora and her little friend, her cousin? She has no parental guidance. I said, what do you mean? He said, everything she does, she's alone. You never see a parent in the, you know, giving her any guidance. She never talks about her parents. She makes decisions on her own. I was like, wow. I never looked at it like that. I said, this is a kid's show. He said, most kids' shows are teaching children. He said, people need to look at what are their children watching. What is this show really teaching them? He said, in that you got one kid talks to animals and strangers and everything. Then you have another one who got all the little people around her. You got the, you know, Swiper who's a thief. So what is he teaching your child? How to steal and how to get away with it? I was like, wow, I never really looked at it like that. So I do believe to say that sometimes when we allow society and television and everything to raise our children, what do we get? We get anger. We get explosive personality. You find out that some of these kids are growing up beating their parents. And then they're out of control. So like you said earlier, it's got to go back to the home. It's got to start in the home.
Absolutely. I have a call at 9389. You're live.
Yes, good afternoon. This is Tony from Miami. You know, I just wanted to, you know, interject a couple of things. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to say, this is my first time listening to the program, and, it sounds great at this point. But, Martin Luther King, he preached about peace. You know, he's a very peaceful man. And, you know, I don't want to say that, you know, we as black people are naturally violent people, because I think that's the type of stereotype that we're portraying ourselves as. If we look at just what recently happened up in Connecticut, you know, those were white people that was involved in those incidents and at the movie theater and with the fire department. So, you know, it's all about how we're raised. And as they say, what you put into your kid, that's what they're going to grow up to learn. That's the path.
Absolutely.
That they're going to grow. You know, I wonder, what happened to church? You know, what happened to education? I was in the store today, and this lady, she had an attack of some sort, and the fire department, Miami-Dade Fire Department, truck number 19, as a matter of fact, pulled up. And, you know, it was like white Cubans on it, you know. I really didn't think much of it. But when they asked the lady, what do you want to do? The lady said, I want to go home. And without, you know, any real consideration or follow-up, they basically said, well, okay, just sign this release stating that you're okay and you can go. You know,
mm-hmm.
And as she left, you know, I later found out that this lady had passed out 3 times in the store. You know, and so if it was one of us in that position, you know, educated to be on that fire rescue truck, we'd have probably been more able to follow up and say, hey, well, listen, are you sure, you know, what's going on here? And not just basically send her on her way, because we don't know what happened to her after that, because, listen, ain't nobody going to save your life. You have to save your own life. And, you know, that's what we have to do for ourselves, because we can't rely on nobody else to do it. So we have to educate ourselves, you know, in the churches spiritually and also educationally to be able to be successful in this life. And those ignorant people out there, yeah, we got to stay strong and keep an eye out for them, but we got to move forward too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that input, Tony. Now, where do you remember Dr. King when he did the speech?
I'm sorry?
Tony, I said, do you remember when Dr. King did the speech? Were you old enough to remember it or remember his assassination?
No, I was not old enough at the time. I was 4 years old.
Okay, you were a baby.
Right.
Thank you so much for calling in with your input. But one of the things that he did say is that we which is why I said when I made the comment as it relates to our young children, our children of color, is because I wanted to be controversial to, you know, bring awareness so that we can take a second look at what are we doing, what have we missed as parents, because I'm sure that there are more parents that know more about Dr. King and know about the sacrifices, know about discrimination. I remember when I moved down here from New York. Now, people always say, oh, New York is one of the hardest cities. Those people are so mean in New York. But I was so comfortable, so at home in New York. I don't know if it was because I was raised there or what, but I didn't fear the people there. And I thought they were the most warmest people that I know. They were more friendlier. Our neighbors looked out for each other. But when I came down here to South Florida, that was my first experience of racism, of discrimination. My first job down here was at this bank called Fidelity Federal. And at this bank, I was the only Black American at this branch. And they had, what do you call that, when they have to go through a training and you know, go through inspection. They were going through that at the time. I was on the job for 90 days when they had to go through this process to make sure that they were up to code with having the right people as far as minorities in place and also making sure that the budget was okay, so forth. And my job was a loan officer. I knew nothing about processing loans or what that meant, but I did loan servicing, and I was good at it. My supervisor always came to me and said, oh, wow, can't believe that you caught on. And I kept saying, you know, wondering why she kept doing it, because every time she would give me something to do, I would do it and handle it and made sure everything was precise, made sure everything was up to par. Well, anyway, unbeknownst to me, the whole thing behind her keep giving me things was she didn't think that I would be able to do it, so it would be an excuse for her to fire me. But I didn't give her an excuse to fire me. I was good at it. So when the inspectors left,
About 1 week later, my supervisor called me into the office, and she said, Valerie, she said, you know, you're great at what you do, and, you know, you certainly look, you know, the part. You're well-groomed. You come to work on time. We don't have any problems with you, but we're going to have to let you go. And I was like, but why? Because I really liked the job. I had a desk job in a bank. I was the only black. And I had a desk job. And she was like, to be honest with you, because she called herself, because she liked me, she was going to tell me the truth. And the truth was I was meeting a quota. That's what she said to me. And she let me go, and she gave me 2 weeks severance pay, plus she gave me a week's vacation time because she liked me. But she had to let me go. That was my first experience of racism ever in my life, was when I moved here to South Florida. I was 21 years old at the time.
Wow. So it doesn't matter if it's in Florida, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, it was more prevalent in the South, racism was.
And I remember I was so angry, and I was a good, nice, saved Christian girl, but I remember smoke coming out of my ears. My face got so hot, it was as though my hair was standing up on my head, because I was like, I dare her humiliate, because I felt humiliated. So I got a taste of what it meant and what it was to my grandparents and my parents to have to have gone through something as traumatic as that. I didn't think it would ever happen to me. I read about it because I loved history. So I always read things like that, and you know, my black history, I was always up on things like that because I wanted to know. And when I experienced it myself, it was one of the most traumatic times in my life. But after I let the heat go down and I got a cool breeze over my face, I shook myself off and I said, she is not going to stop me. And I persevered and went and got another job. And every job I was at, you know, one of the things we fail at doing when opposition comes is we want to get even physically. But the thing is, we got to get even mentally in our mind. We have to educate ourselves so that we can go to the next level. And that's what I began doing. I began educating myself. And most of the jobs I had after that, every job I had, I was in an authority position. I would go in to be hired as administrative assistant, where I wind up, you know, working with the president of the company, and then they would just leave me to run things. And these were Jewish bosses I had that gave me the power and authority. I'm only 5 feet, and they gave this little petite woman authority to make decisions. Mostly every job I had after that, I was in some type of authority. So you have to be able to govern yourself and carry yourself retrospectively so that people won't judge you by the color of your skin, but judge you by your knowledge, your wisdom, and the way you carry yourself. Your demeanor speaks volumes when we're living in situations such as this. And from that, I was able to roller coaster and run. Matter of fact, the last job I had that I actually worked on, a 9-to-5 job, I was working at this printing company, and the president of the company came in, because I actually ran her whole company. She didn't even have to come in. And she came over to me. She asked me, why was I there? And I was like, excuse me? She says, I don't understand why you're working this job. You're
far, way more qualified. I was there almost 3 years. I was there 2.5 years. And I really didn't think I was going to be there that long. And when she hired me, I knew nothing about the job, nothing about what it is. But I told her. And I have four little children still in school. And I never missed a day of work. I was never absent for foolishness. Matter of fact, I think I only took like one sick day. And when I had to take my kids to doctor's appointments, I went to that. I tried to schedule their doctor's appointments where I could come back to work or be able to complete whatever work I knew I was responsible for at that job. And we don't take pride in our work. So how can somebody trust you with something when you don't have any regard for the authority and the power that people allow you to have? We take advantage sometimes of, you know, what people, how they pride in us. We take advantage of that trust that they lay upon us. And I never took advantage of that. What I did was took the time to learn everything they learned because of the fact that I didn't go to college. I didn't have the opportunity to go to college. I was busy trying to help my brothers and sisters, you know, get their schoolwork. So every summer I would work and save money to help my parents buy school supplies and school clothes for my siblings. And when they wanted to go to school, I helped with that. So I had to make sacrifices along the way so that I could be who I am today. And I think that is what a lot of people have missed in this dispensation that we're living in. The power of the dream. What have you done with the power of the dream? Shirley?
Awesome, girl. That is something that we really all need to think about, the power of the dream. What each individual has done, what impact have they put into someone else's life and even their own lives. You know, I look at myself, you know, like I said, you know, the Mississippi part really holds dear to me with my children and with that power that I work with other children in trying to help them. I started a mentoring program for at-risk youth. And, you know, Val, listening to you and how you poured into your children's life and the rest of your family's life, you know, it brings me back to what I did with my life. I didn't go to school at first because my parents died early. My mom died very young. And so I was, you know, we moved from Mississippi to Michigan. So as a young girl, leaving Mississippi at the age of 12, and then growing up in Michigan in the northern area. See, you went from the north to the south, and I went from the south to the north. So we just did a flip-flop. And growing up, you know, in the north, so it was different for me. It was so different to come to the north and have what I called a different sense of freedom. Free to walk, you know, without feeling, you know, that you got to watch your back as you walk the street.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or is there a car going to pass by and someone is going to yell out some slur to you? So that was different for me as a young girl moving to Michigan and having that, being able to, as I say, let down my guard and walk, you know, because I had to walk to school here. And when we was in the South, we rode the bus. But, you know, at first my mom was kind of nervous about us walking and everything. And I was like, Mom, it just seems so different here that, you know, we're not getting that. And see, and that's why you said you never experienced racism until you went south. And I had never experienced what it felt like to be treated like another human being as far as no racism, even though it was there, but it wasn't as prevalent. I had more of a sense of freedom because we lived in Pontiac, which was majority black, which that was a culture shock for me in the beginning because I'm like, where did all these black people come from?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was like, okay, and then I went to my school, and which I was used to being in a school that was all black, But when I got to the school, it was a mix. And I'm like, wow. So we all go to school together here. So it was a taste of the dream. I received the taste of the dream at the age of 12, when I could interact and play with other children, and my skin color didn't matter. That I can interact and go and sit at a table with them and have lunch or, you know, in the cafeteria. My skin color didn't matter. My teachers were white. My teachers were black. The skin color didn't matter. They were there to teach us. So I experienced the dream at the age of 12.
Wow.
My parents always talked to us about the dream, but to actually live the dream. And I see my father working in the plant, bringing home money. I mean, we were like, oh, man, we're rich now. Because coming from the South, you know what I'm saying? And then going to the North, and then Daddy buying a house. We weren't renting a home. He bought a home. So that was like the American dream. Buying a new car, all of this, and not having to buy a car from someone that he used to work with, or he worked on their land or in their farms and everything, and he bought their car that they no longer wanted. He actually went to the dealership and bought a new car. So that all of that experience for me was a part of the dream.
Yes.
And they made sure that we understood that this is what Dr. King talked about when he said, I have a dream. That one day we would be able to do these things. So that in itself was something huge for me and all of my siblings.
Great. You know, when my supervisors asked me what was I doing there, I was like, I looked at her, I said, are you firing me? And she was like, no. She says, no, I'm just trying to figure out why someone with so much talent is doing this job. I said, well, because I have four kids and I need the insurance, you know, and I need the money. And she was like, but you're so overqualified for this job, for this position. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but she actually gave me the extra push out to do what I'm doing right now, and I've not looked back, because I thought about it when she said, because, you know, you get so much in this format of doing things, and I just was comfortable. But she was a Caucasian lady, but she saw something in me and was willing to go out on a limb and push me out the door. And when she did that, I was like, you know, I am overqualified. I could do more. I could actually make more money. But I was afraid. And that's what happens a lot of times, is we operate and we walk in fear of the unknown. I have a caller holding 0198. Are you there?
Hello.
Hello.
How are you all?
Well, good. We're great.
Awesome, awesome. My name is Myra, and I'm from Texas. And
hello, Myra.
I am born in the South, raised in the South, and I'm still in the South. had an awesome childhood. I grew up in an extended family with people born as early as the late 1800s or the early 1900s, because you know how censuses were wrong. But so I experienced good and bad with, you know, racism, and I've also experienced good and bad with white people, black people, both sides, growing up early.
Right.
So that taught me that there's good and bad in all people. But there was a question earlier that said, how do you get the kids engaged?
Yes.
And one thing I think the school system didn't do with the kids that I've had to do with my own, and that it was done for me as well, you can't start a kid with civil rights and expect them to understand it. You can't skip from slavery to civil rights. They got to know about the Jim Crow era. And that's up to us as adults to make sure they understand the bridge of that gap for it really to take place. And I always make for my son, the oldest one, to understand it from my grandfather's eyes. And that really brings it home, because he knew his great-grandfather. So when he hears what happened to his grandmother or his great-grandfather and the personal experiences that they had, it makes it more real for him. And I also instill in him, you know, don't come to me telling me you don't want to read. When people got beat back in the day, or worse,
right,
because they couldn't read. So, but you all talk about freedom. I remember one time as a kid, there was this little cross, not a big cross, but a little cross that the Ku Klux Klan burned because my grandmother spoke up and spoke out about something. So, but I was taught not to be fearful, because you take God and you go with it.
Right.
So my family taught me that white people, black people, whoever, nobody's better than anybody, to have a sense of pride regardless. I went to school in all-black situation, transferred to mixed situation, and we were instilled by our black teachers, our white teachers, and all, you have pride in yourself, and you don't let anybody make you feel less of a person.
Amen. Yes,
I'm enjoying
thank
the
you
show.
So much for sharing that. And you're standing here, and one of the things I like that you said is that you started teaching your children from the Jim Crow area.
Mm-hmm.
Can you enlighten a little bit for those that are listening and don't know what that is?
The Jim Crow era was where, as y'all kept saying, it's not as prevalent. The racism and the discrimination was really prevalent, where blacks got discriminated in housing, in jobs, in restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my people that are older than me actually did the sit-ins. You know, they went to the counters, and I hear those stories and everything. In my city, the movie The Great Debaters was taken.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I actually have an uncle who we had this sit-in, Matheson Drugs, I think was the name of it, was one of them, but they had more than one. And they didn't allow black people, but they actually went in and did that. So to hear that just excited me. And to know that my grandfather, Neil, he had a sixth-grade education, but this man took a gift from God, and he got jobs with white people when most black people didn't get jobs with white people. So, it was instilled in us. The dream is you do not allow the color of your skin to allow anybody to keep you from doing what you're supposed to do. And then we have to continue to bridge the gap. Yes, strides have been made, but as you all said, we have a long way to go. But it starts, as Michael Jackson said, with a man in the mirror.
Oh, yes.
Each one reach one.
Oh, yeah. Indeed.
Thank you so much.
That's the truth of the whole concept. Thank you so much for joining in and giving that comment. But that is the truth and reality of it all, that whatever we're facing, whatever we're going through, that it begins with us. It can begin with us, and it can stop with us. And we need to function in a way where we want to be somebody. Because as I said at the beginning of the show, that was one of my greatest thoughts. That was my biggest drive, was that I wanted to be somebody. I wanted to make a contribution to mankind, as Horace Mann stated, that every man should want to be able to do in this dispensation of this life that we've been given here on this planet. We're about to end the show, and in closing the show, I'm going to play the last excerpt of Dr. King's Dream. And please join me next week, and also replay the show, pass it along to families and friends, and join us next week as we continue with the dream and some of our other African Americans who have played a major contribution in our society today. And also visit my website, www.fromthesoulofawoman.com, and hopefully you'll find some resources on there that will help you get to the next level. I look forward to hearing you next week on Hot Topics from the Soul.
I have a dream. One day, this nation will arise up, live out the true meaning of its creed.
And that concludes our Hot Topics from the Soul. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.